Matt Bubala Show here on 720 WGN. Thanks for hanging out even later with us, everybody. 3 o'clock in the morning here in Chicago, which means it's about 8 o'clock in the morning in London, where Matt Cole joins us from the BBC. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Good, thank you, Matt. Good to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us on the phone. So you guys had another attack. How do we characterize what happened in London earlier this week as of right now? Because I'm reading some stories on BBC.com about how this happened and how the city has been preparing since the last attacks, because, you know, it's not as, I guess the attacks these days are becoming less and less complex, well carried out, well organized things that a lot of people are involved in, because those are getting broken down more easily. How are the agencies that responded and the police looking at what happened and what could have been done, or overall, is this the type of thing that's going to happen once in a while and there's only so much that can be done to stop it?
Well, look, the central question, Matt, is did Khalid Massoud, the man who drove an SUV vehicle at 70 miles an hour across Westminster Bridge, plowing through people before crashing the car, taking a knife and attacking and killing a policeman, PC Keith Palmer, in the gates of Parliament. The question is, did he act alone? And I think that is the concern, really, for the police here at the moment and the security agencies. They want to know, did he have any associates, or was he someone who was just inspired somehow to this act of terror? The question still remains, of course, as to whether possibly he was just a man who was ill. It is just not clear at the moment, because of course he was himself shot dead moments into his attack within the gates of Parliament. But at the moment there is a concern from the law enforcement agencies here. Did he act alone? Was he inspired by terrorist propaganda? If there are others who've encouraged or supported or directed him. Now, this is the growing concern, that the last major attack, of course, in London was back in 2005, when four men detonated bombs in backpacks, three on underground tubes, one on a London bus. There was an attempt a fortnight later by four more people to do similar. Their backpacks didn't detonate, thankfully. The same carnage wasn't repeated, but that seemed a much more coordinated effort. It is this sort of lone attacker, lone wolf type style of event that has been concerning the security agencies, because while they do monitor huge numbers of people of concern, they can't be monitoring all people all of the time.
Yeah.
And certainly this man, Khalid Massoud, had been on their radar some years ago, but was dismissed as a man rather peripheral to anything of concern.
Mm. That sounds like San Bernardino and what happened here not that long ago in America. So what is the latest right now? Was there any a note left behind when they check his apartment? You know, I imagine pretty quickly they could tell if this was somebody who maybe was really planning something for a while, at least. To the degree of how much he might be involved with others maybe could remain unknown, but I would think very quickly they'd gather whether or not this was somebody who'd been planning something for a long time, had a lot of things in his apartment or other indicators, or if it was somebody who just maybe was suddenly inspired, because it seems a little haphazard, doesn't it, that you just run over people on a bridge and then attack a police officer with a knife. It doesn't seem, at least on the surface, and I'm no terrorism expert, but it doesn't seem incredibly coordinated and planned out.
Well, at the moment, there is a massive police operation going. So certainly in terms of his motivation, if police have even begun to establish that, they haven't released that information. But we do understand detectives have seized something like 2,500 items from searches at least three addresses. They've got massive amounts of computer data to go through. They've spoken to around 3,500 witnesses already. One of the big questions I think they have at the moment is to do with a secure message that he sent about 2 minutes before launching the attack. The question is, was that encrypted message from his phone to an accomplice, or could it perhaps have been to a loved one, a farewell message? Again, until that is cracked and reviewed, the police won't know. And certainly the nature of the way police investigations happen in the UK is you tend not to get masses of information released. It's only perhaps if ever charges were brought that you then discover this. Now, obviously, in this case, the suspect at the moment is a lone person. person. So perhaps that information, if they establish he worked alone, will be released. But of course, if others are brought into it and then there's potentially a trial, a lot of this evidence would only appear then so as not to prejudice any of the proceedings. But I think there is a genuine concern at the moment as to whether this is a man who worked alone, and therefore there have been a number of arrests, but then people released. 11 people have been arrested in raids, but only two of those now remain under arrest in custody. Two women have been released on what's known as police bail, but then another seven have been completely released, no further action to be taken. So there is a huge operation, but at the moment, I suppose a lot of the focus here in London is thinking about the victims, thinking about those who remain in hospital, and of course thinking about those who've died, PC Keith Palmer, and not least, of course, Kurt Cochran from Utah.
Yeah, that's a tragic story. Family, I believe, on a 25th year anniversary trip to England and overseas, and and I have a good friend I actually used to work with at another radio station who happened to be not right there, but less than a mile away when it happened, who was over there on vacation with her son. So it strikes, and it does affect everyone everywhere. How is the city holding up? You guys have been through this before. You guys have, I mean, let's face it, England has a long history of weathering the storm, right, when it comes to various things. How is everybody holding up?
This is a city that is rather used to, if not the actual incidents like this, then the potential threat of them. And the sense of the traditional British stiff upper lip and carrying on really does pervade matters like this. The cordon that was put round Westminster was tight and was there for 24, 36 hours or so. I was caught up within it. Our office is next to Parliament, and so the first we knew of this was when we saw people out the window streaming and running away from the events as they were unfolding before the security lockdown took place. But just beyond that, you would have people in typical British fashion who are probably grumbling about the fact their bus was now on diversion. great, huge compassion for those who have been injured and killed, and great sadness for them. I mean, it neatly underlining the concern and thoughts people have for the victims. A charity fund has been set up for the police constable who was killed. That's now raised over £500,000 for his family.
Wow.
A huge sum of money people have poured in. But I think the rest of the city, well, that night, the bars were full, the pubs were full. The following morning, people went back to work. Parliament itself sat at 9:30 the following morning, only pausing for a minute's silence at 9:33, which was the shoulder number of the police guard who had been killed. People get up and they carry on, and I think that is the way of it, and why you had, therefore, our Prime Minister Theresa May with a very simple message on Wednesday morning for those who might have been hoping to profit from the terror this has caused, by simply a simple message that said, we are not afraid. And I think most Britons, yes, would be nervous, and yes, would be concerned. Those of us who work in the environs of Parliament, it is uncomfortable. We are conscious that there is potentially a threat, but I suppose the main death, the main carnage happened on an ordinary road, the bridge over a Westminster Bridge. It's just a regular road within London. There's nothing in a sense special. It's a great view to see some wonderful iconic buildings, but it's like every other road in a sense across the country. So you are potentially as vulnerable there as anywhere else. Now, don't get me wrong. Clearly, this was picked as a target for its iconic, simply, you think of London anywhere in the world, you're going to think of the Big Ben Tower, you're going to think of that sort of skyline image that the parliamentary buildings give you. That's why it was picked, the home of the oldest democracy on the planet. But people in London, well, you know, you get up, you dust yourself down, you say you're not going to be scared, and you carry on.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's, of course, right, you hate to use the word brilliance, but that's what makes a terror attack like that smart, because it makes you feel no matter where you are, you're vulnerable. This could happen anywhere on any ordinary bridge. You're right. It was set, of course, to get the most bang for its buck. But anytime a terrorist attack happens in a place you or I could be at any time, it makes you stop and pause. And that's how they win in minds, I think, at least. They want to just make people scared, make people worried. And that's how they achieve that. All right, Matt, I want to grab you for just a couple more minutes, if you're willing, because I want to talk about something a little lighter. I love getting the perspective. I had your colleague Julie McFarlane on a couple of weeks ago to talk a little bit about what you guys are thinking about what we're doing over on this side of the pond. Because, as you know, I don't know if you've heard, Matt, we elected a new president. He took office just this year, and it's been very interesting so far. And, you know, I know he was scheduled to come visit. There was a lot of consternation on your side about this visit. And I believe his visit got moved to Scotland or something like that. I don't know how soon this is coming up. But what are you guys, when you're sitting around having tea in the afternoon and chatting about Americans, are you guys laughing? Are you taking it seriously? Are you worried? What are the thoughts over there about what we got going on over here?
Well, first things first, I'm a big coffee drinker, rarely drink tea.
I stereotyped you there. I'm sorry about that.
I think shocking, absolutely shocking. Look, listen, I think there's a huge amount of interest in what goes on in the States, and people followed very closely the entire procedure of President Trump coming to power right from the early days of the primaries and so on. He's a figure who was known over here, not just because shows like The Apprentice, the USA version, we have our own British version over here too, but the US version was known here, Donald Trump, for his golf courses and big properties and larger-than-life persona. He was known here, and so this was sort of followed with interest from the day he declared. And so now that he is president, yeah, he is considered something of a divisive figure over here, and certainly when it came to the very early invitation from the Prime Minister, Theresa May, that there would be an official state visit offer extended, people were somewhat surprised. Simply sort of diplomatically and in protocol terms, it would be natural for the British government to kind of get a sense of the tone and the direction of a foreign government's, you know, way of thinking and acting before perhaps offering the highest level of a visit, a state visit, a full state visit, tends to involve staying with the Queen at Buckingham Palace. There are obviously much lesser visits where you can just come and meet the Prime Minister or just come and, you know, have a look around sort of thing. So I think there was quite a lot of surprise that so early. But at the moment, from our point of view, Britain is in a rather curious point of political turmoil itself. It has voted in the last year to leave the collective body of that's known as the European Union. That's 28 countries within Europe that kind of share trade and all sorts of aspects of life. Now, because Britain is leaving that body, it's looking out to the world now, and therefore is perhaps all the more going to be looking towards that so-called special relationship with the United States, and therefore I think looking to Donald Trump has been a sort of a very early thought from Theresa May, and therefore it's even more being closely watched here in the UK. So the ups and downs of the votes on healthcare last night and the questions over Russian involvement, people are following that with great fascination, both in terms of the pure theatre and soap opera of it, but also with concern that this is potentially, after Britain leaves the European Union, once again the most important global ally we could have, and therefore the stability or otherwise of the States is all the more crucial to people here.
There was so much news over here during Brexit when all the vote went down, when all of that happened. It really was a huge deal over here. And a lot of the huge deal was the concern over what was going to happen and whether London or whether England made a mistake and things like that. It's really seemed to die down since then. Now, maybe that's just because we have enough going on over here that we're not paying as much attention. What is the feeling now that you've gotten pretty far away from the vote? Have people accepted this will be okay, we'll work through this, or is there a lot of regret? Is there still talk about trying to get back in and stopping the Brexit? Where's the feelings now?
Well, look, we haven't actually left yet. There is a process for leaving. You have to notify the other members of the European Union.
It's going to take like a couple of years, right?
Yeah, fully? Basically you have you notify the European Union you're going to leave. That is actually scheduled to happen this coming Wednesday, the 29th. That then triggers a process which is 2 years of negotiations to negotiate, if you like, the divorce. Quite literally, things like who gets the kids. So as things stand, being a member of the European Union allows you as a UK citizen to live and work in any other member state and vice versa. So one of the big questions they're dealing with is the 3 million people from other EU countries. What will their status be in the UK when we leave and vice versa? There's over 1.5 to 2 million Brits who live around Europe and can work without any sort of documentation, you know, other than their British passport. Now, that could change. So those questions are what will be dominating those 2 years of negotiations. But in terms of the controversy around it, that's not gone away at all. People are still debating whether economically this will be a brilliant opportunity to make new trade links around the world that we would now be able to do ourselves rather than having to do through the European Union, which is one of the key sort of bugbears for opponents of the EU, is that you don't do your own trade deals when you're a member. You have to do it collectively as part of the 28-member bloc. So there are questions as to whether Britain as an island nation will be able to get good deals from the likes of the States or Brazil, India, China, Australia, who knows? And so the controversy and the complexity of leaving is still leaving people scratching their heads because we've had 40 years of integration. Imagine, for example, what if you had California suddenly decided it wanted to leave the United States? How could that even begin to happen? The federal taxes, the agencies, who gets what portion of what? It's not quite to that extent, but it's not dissimilar in terms of how the UK extracts itself. The European Union Medicines Agency is based here. That's the one that licenses medicines to be safe across Europe. Well, that will have to go back somewhere in Europe, and that means the UK won't actually have a medicines agency. We'll need to set one up. If we have customs tariffs, we'll now have to. There's all these huge things that people just haven't worked out yet. And I think that's causing great consternation and controversy. Those who are still very much in favour of it are absolutely saying it's going to be okay. Those who are never convinced it was a good idea, I don't think many of them are yet to be convinced otherwise.
And in your opinion, how is it all going to turn out? Do you think it will fully go through? Because it does take such a long time. There still could be some backtracking on it, right? That is still a possibility?
I think politically that would be very difficult for the government. The prevailing political narrative here is that Britain is leaving. Now, once you trigger that Article 50 leaving mechanism, it's known as Article 50 because that was the clause in the rule book of the EU that finally put in place a mechanism by which you could leave. Now, once that Article 50 leaving mechanism is triggered, some people aren't even sure if you could then change your mind, whether it just automatically you end up leaving. Because certainly if no leaving deal is done within 2 years, you do just drop out of the union, switch onto World Trade Organization trading rules. So politically, it's very hard. There are people saying that we should, for example, once we've worked out what our exit deal is, that should be put back to the people in terms of a referendum. There are plenty of people who say, no, the public have spoken. But people pick through this. Two-thirds of the public voted. That was roughly 50-50, but ever so slightly 52-48 in favour of leaving. So some people say, look, only a third of the UK actually voted to get out. It's complicated. In my opinion, I mean, I spent a couple of years actually based over in Brussels at the heart of the European Union. What I do know is that everything it does, whether you're pro or anti it, is complicated. Negotiations are complicated. It is very hard to see how a lot of this deal making can be done in the time frame, not necessarily because things on the British end, but because of the slow turning circle of getting the 27 other people on the other side of the negotiating table to coordinate their response, let alone then focus it on the UK. My best guess is that there could be some kind of interim deal. It could be drawn out. But it is the honest, absolute answer is that no one knows. No one actually knows how this is going to plan out. We may need a bit of that stiff British upper lip just to kind of, you know, tough through it and see whether there's some good times ahead.
When you think about how complex that must be with all those countries, you wonder how the European Union ever came together in the first place. It's amazing to think about that it was pulled together, you know, at all. That had to be so difficult at the time. And now for somebody to say, yeah, we're going to get out of it, you have some interesting days ahead. I will tell you this, though, Matt. I don't know how much you know about our President Trump, but here's the thing. So if you guys pull out and you're like, okay, U.S. might become a very more important trading partner, things like that, we got to work out separate deals. Here's the thing about our President Trump. He really likes to stick it to the people he's working with. Now, he won't say, you know, he will say that, actually. He wants to win. So I don't think we will ever hear President Trump say something like, this is a deal that's great for both sides. Now, maybe he'll say that if, like, you know, Theresa May was standing next to him at the podium. But a lot of what he talks about is wanting to win. And we got screwed on this. We got this. We got this. They're taking advantage of us. So I believe Donald Trump's real art of the deal is either screw or be screwed. And he's going to be looking. So just be a little wary if he comes offering things and saying, yeah, we're going to do a deal. It's going to be a huge deal. It's going to be the greatest deal we've ever seen. He means for us. He doesn't mean for you guys at all.
Well, thank you for the heads up. I think This, I mean, actually, laughing aside, people did spot this, that obviously in his inaugural speech, it very much was America for the Americans, America first. Oh. I think that was a point very quickly put to our Prime Minister. Hang on, you're looking to make a trade deal. You visited within a week or so of him taking office. Hang on, is this a guy that we can really do business with? Because he clearly isn't that interested in us. But
no.
Certainly, Theresa May being the first international leader to come and visit, I think, warmed the hearts here. And I think people are optimistic. He said that he can make it. I don't know how well it would have been reported there. He said he thinks that a deal can be done very quickly, because certainly President Obama had spoken in terms of if the UK leaves the European Union, it's going to get to the back of the queue when it comes to trade deals. I think Donald Trump, sort of emphasising his Scottish ancestry and the links he has to the UK, has spoken in more positive terms. But I think people will go into negotiations here very wary and open-eyed, that his focus is very much on the US end of the deal, not necessarily the UK side.
Interesting times ahead for all of us. Matt Cole from the BBC. You can follow him on Twitter at BBC Matt Cole, C-O-L-E, at BBC Matt Cole. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. It was great to talk to you. I hope we can do this again, Matt.
You're most welcome, Matt, anytime.
All right, have a great weekend. That's Matt Cole from the BBC at BBC Matt Cole on Twitter. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.